We've been talking about Lash makes no apologies for not presenting a detailed list of proposals. You remember, for how to improve the quality of life in this age of diminishing expectations, as his title calls it. And he always remains a critic, pointing to problems, and I suppose the idea being that through his criticisms to generate enough interest to lead to some sort of specific action. But obviously there are sort of norms and criterias and values on which his criticism rests. And as I've suggested before, some of these are muted, they're implicit, but you know, definitely they are there. And I'd like to suggest sort of three of these, and then if go through especially the third one in some detail. Mm-hmm. And then if you know, whichever one you want to pick up on would be fine. But I think what he really would like to see, by way of correcting some of the things we've talked about, and we've talked about, you know, the rise of the narcissistic personality, and then the impact on the work ethic, and then last time on leisure and sport and that, and what he'd really like to I think get at is, first of all, sort of a restoration of enthusiasm and trust in the political process, the way, you know, in which it was originally intended, you know, in the 18th century, sort of a Jeffersonian view of what, you know, what politics could be. He talks about this because, as I think, I'll just read this one pair thing, and then I'll go on to the other two. His confidence, or his trust, I should say, or maybe his faith in politics, has to come out of these two sentences. After the political turmoil of the 60s, Americans have retreated to purely personal preoccupations. Which means that he sees the 60s as largely, you know, a time of political involvement and commitment. You remember our program on King we had the other night and so on. All right. Having no hope of improving their lives in any of the ways that matter. In other words, he's trying to say that that's the way I get it from that, is that the only way in which we can really improve our lives collectively is through politics. And he's saying now that's pretty well, that's over. People have convinced themselves that what matters in life is psychic self-improvement, and then we talked in terms of some of the other things, you know, like belly dancing and Eastern wisdom and jogging and so on and so forth. But anyway, politics is one, and I'd be glad if, you know, we want to pick up on that a little bit later on how he would like to do that. A second idea that I pick up in him, and it's a little more difficult to spell out precisely, is that he seems to want to restore a much clearer sense of morality, of right and wrong, in both public discourse and in private behavior. What he's afraid of is coming out of some of the schools of psychology, especially Skinner and behaviorism, is the idea that there really isn't any right and wrong. There aren't the old sort of traditional norms and standards anymore of what makes an issue, an idea, a policy, whatever it is, like right and wrong. But he would like to return to this. One thing I didn't have, and I should have brought it along, that's where I got this thing on Skinner. There's a new biography out on Skinner, and Lash reviewed it for New Republic. And wrote a devastating criticism of behaviorism, because Skinner tried to reduce everything to sort of a bland life of reinforcement, and what Lash would like to see is that life is a matter of moral struggle, of passion and commitment, and we've sort of lost this sense in our day and age. As far as I can see, he would like to sort of in a very real sense return to some sort of traditional norms in morality. And so on. And the third thing that he talks about a great deal, and he's written another book that came out 2 years earlier as sort of a warm-up to this one, and he's very much preoccupied with personal relationships, especially with the family. His book in 1977 dealt it got into this sort of trendy thing of everybody writing about the families in that period, but it was a remarkable book. And this is what I want to sort of build on tonight, is what he would like to have restored in terms of what we've talked about before, remember, with not being able to identify with the past and having no hope for the future and so on. He'd like to restore a much greater concern for long-term personal relationships, for commitments, for sacrifice, making sacrifices for one another, through re-strengthening the nuclear family, through strengthening marriage, through strengthening interdependence on one another. And the way he would, you know, there are specific ways in which he would like to do this, so far as I can tell, eliciting, you know, from different parts of this book. For one thing, we've talked about this so much, you'll know what I mean here. He'd like, as much as possible, to eliminate consumptionism as an end in itself. For those who haven't been here, we've gone through consumptionism enough, I guess, to know that we've whipped that horse enough times, haven't we? But it's still a very real problem, and he sees consumptionism as one real threat to the traditional norms and standards for the family and long-term relationships, because it's a matter, consumptionism gets you into, you know, personal gratification rather than dedication and concern and sacrifice for one another. Secondly, he would, and he has a chapter on this that we didn't talk about, he would like to get back to what we would call sort of basic education in the public schools, return to almost a kind of a classical kind of education in which the issues really are in literature and the social studies and all the rest of these things are moral issues, in which you aren't afraid to confront the students any longer with significant moral questions and problems. Instead of some things that he sees that he doesn't like, I don't know if you know Professor Simon's values clarification system, but he sees as a step backwards. Some other people see it as a step forward. We can, you know, if you want to follow that, we can certainly take that one up. He would like to see what we would, you know, be more familiar with here, I suppose. Religious institutions and organizations assert themselves really more vigorously as custodians of ultimate truth claims in a world where technology and all the rest are technology is making so many changes in our lives that we can no longer depend on any traditional institution such as the church has been as a custodian for specific kinds of truth claims. But most of all, I think he would like to return to a sense that life, as I've already talked about, I guess here when I was ad-libbing, that life is a moral struggle, which will cause pain, suffering, which will demand sacrifices, which will demand compromises, commitments over a long period of time. And so that once people are caught up, or I should say accept the idea of moral struggle and commitment, they'll be willing to make the sacrifices, and that, he says, is the one thing more than anything else that can restore a sense of continuity with both the past and also to be reasonably optimistic about the future. This is the thing that bothers him more than anything else, is that our lives have changed so much that we no longer can identify with the past and we no longer have any hope for the future, but the way in which we can get in touch with both the past and the future again, and you remember he is a historian, is through personal or experiential kinds of involvements ourselves, staying especially through the family, because he sees the family as a custodian of traditional wisdom and knowledge and insight and training and all that, and from one generation to the next, and the fact that people are willing to make these kinds of sacrifices and for one another rather than simply trade in partners or whatever it is for the next year's new model as it comes out, in all those different forms. Okay. Anyway, so what I want to look at with that background in mind is his chapter on what he calls the, and I didn't think Werner was able to handle some of these big words, that's why I had a snappy title tonight, the flight from feeling, social psychology of the sex war. I thought that if I had used that for a title, that might have thought, people would have thought that I was using a little bit sensationalistic kind of advertising, for tonight, and they should go to some of the other ones too. All right, but anyway, social psychology of the sex war. Now, this is really a key chapter that I want to outline in some detail. All right, what he argues first of all is that if there's going to be this kind of return to more traditional norms and standards in morality and concern for the family, for children, for continuity, and all the rest. That there has to be a return to a sense of personal responsibility for one's own behavior in the world, and that is a very conservative kind of idea, a sense sort of that each of us are personally responsible for what we do and what happens in the world, that we can't blame it all on big business, or we can't blame it all on technology or the mass media or some of the other devils that we've been kicking around in the programs here during these last 3 weeks. All right, the expression, "Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me," would be one example there. But he doesn't stop there, and that's important because a lot of quote conservatives do stop at that particular point. That the only way in which we're going to improve the world is to put ourselves right, our own lives in order, and then once we do that, then the rest of the world will fall in order. One more Kenyan story here. I was so impressed by our minister, who once did a illustration for us about this exact idea. And what he had done was to cut up a page of a newspaper, and then he put the it, it, what it was a picture of a man, And he put all the different parts of the body and the head and the arms and all the members together. And once he had them all sort of pasted together with scotch tape and all the rest, and it all was just right, then he turned it over, and lo and behold, there was the world, and the world was all in place. And the idea being that if you put yourself together, the world will take care of itself. And the difficulty with that is, obviously, that it doesn't do much in eliminating what we might call sort of social sin or social maladjustment in the world, that there are some sort of institutional problems created over which persons, no matter how dedicated they might be to improving justice and order and decency in the world, are simply unable to do very much about that. So anyway, he calls for is both the restoration of a sense of personal responsibility, and also he would call for one more attempt at working through public institutions such as the government, through such as the schools, the public agencies, to restore a sense of responsibility to their constituencies. Again, he argues, much like Norman Cousins argues about public agencies. He said we don't know enough yet to be pessimistic, or we don't know enough yet to be cynical about them. But there's still some reason, obviously, for optimism with this. All right. He argues this is one way of doing it, but then he gets more specifically into what he calls the social psychology of the sex war as an illustration of how difficult this is going to be in our time, and why it's nice to talk about platitudes about restoring personal a sense of personal responsibility and getting more morality back into the government and all the rest of these things. And he recognizes that these are fairly obvious almost platitudes, and that there are some enormous obstacles ahead. All right. He says that as far as he's concerned, the thing that has created the most difficulty so far as this restoration of a sense of commitment and morality and a sense of long-range responsibility is what has been called, in our time, the sexual revolution. All right. He argues that there, and first I'll go through what he disagrees with and then what he does finally agree with on this. He argues that many people have been deceived. This is Lash's argument. Many people have been deceived by what they think is, quote, the freedom, the liberation, whatever you want to call it, of the so-called sexual revolution in our day and age. All right. Now, the superficial signs that so many people believe in, that there is greater, quote, of sort of freedom in our day and age, is for one thing, the diminishing importance of rearing children. And for many people, this is sort of a step ahead. That rearing children is not necessarily seen as the sine qua non of a successful or a stable kind of marriage with this. All right. Because so many people feel that freed from having to rear children, they are more free, they have more time to concentrate on themselves. Secondly, he argues that the sexual revolution has taught that people are more willing or freed up, so to speak, to enjoy the more physical side of the marriage relationship, because there's no longer the fear of pregnancy, and therefore people can concentrate more on that phase of marriage rather than think of marriage only as a means for reproduction. With this, and third, he argues that with the obvious greater public tolerance towards what we call being sexually active, that in the world today, that people no longer have the old traditional kinds of hang-ups or taboos about the sanctity of the marriage relationship, and therefore they are more, how should I say this, are more capable of finding satisfactory sexual relationships without being tied to what they used to consider to be unnecessarily harsh and restrictive, traditional norms and standards. And to him, what he's saying here is a lot of people see this as really as a sign, or as a, that's not the word I want, as a, I lost it there for a minute, as a symptom of much greater freedom, and hence, if there's much greater freedom, there should be much greater happiness. But he argues that all the significant signs suggest that it isn't going in that direction at all. And that he argues that this apparent, quote, freedom that Americans think that they have is not really freedom at all. And he goes, and I'll just go through his argument here rather carefully. He says this, that the cult of intimacy, he says, conceals a growing despair of finding real freedom. All right. Now, and this is what he means by that. The inability, quote, to take an interest in anything after one's own death, is, which of course is a mark of the narcissist, means that intimacy is harder than ever to achieve than before. Just as the older traditional ties between parents and children have been weakened, he argues, so too have ties between men and women. Indeed, he argues that it is this deterioration, that is a deterioration between men and women that he finds today, which contributes to the deterioration between parents and children. And he has some very presents some very strong convictions on this. All right. Now, what's his evidence that instead of the sexual revolution creating more freedom, it's actually creating more deterioration, in a sense of decline that he feels is at the bottom of so many of the problems that are facing us today. All right, he says that the growing incidence of divorce, plus the expectations that marriages will most likely collapse, and he points to the fact that oftentimes people start planning their divorce at the same time they're planning their marriage. This is just sort of something that's expected now of the time. He said, adds to the instability of family life. And he says it deprives, and this is where he gets sort of traditional, he says that this deprives a child of a measure of emotional security. And he puts that was in italics in the book. This deprives a child of a measure of emotional security. All right. But he says the, quote, enlightened wisdom of our day argues that this is not the case. It says that the children are better off when they don't have to see the parents being hostile towards one another. And Lash says that sometimes, you know, this is possibly true. But he says what happens, is happening that he doesn't like, is that when a marriage does break down, the father leaves the children for the wife, and the courts certainly, you know, lean in this direction that all the other things being equal, in a custody case, it's usually the mother who's given final custody, and that the mother then in this kind of situation, he says, smothers the child or the children with incessant, yet, as he calls it, perfunctory attention. The father is absent. And to Lash, this is probably the most striking feature about the contemporary family. I think maybe you remember that wonderful little vignette in Woody Allen's Manhattan when they had the basketball game on Sunday afternoon, and the sweatshirts that they all wore, divorced fathers, and sons and daughters or whatever it was, and that they had their own league as an example of this. All right. And to him, he sees this as I say, the most striking feature about the contemporary family, which is something he feels is something of a misnomer. Anyway, he said either splitting or staying together. You remember that song in Nashville, For the Good of the Children, is a sorry kind of a turn of events. And he says all the books about creative divorce that are, you know, so popular at this time really are simply ill-founded, because there's nothing really creative about it. All right, now, what Lash finds behind this trend that I've outlined here is the thing that I've talked about before, but I want to develop in a slightly different sense here, is the inability to make and to keep long-range commitments and sacrifices, and to see issues in moral terms, and to prepare for the fact that this is going to be a part of life when you do choose to make a commitment. What he says has happened instead of that is that in our day and age in our day and age, it has developed open warfare. Really, that's the term he actually uses, open warfare, more than ever before between the sexes. And this is really the result, he says, of the collapse for all practical purposes of the nuclear family. Now, he gives his reasons for this, the open warfare between the sexes and the collapse of the nuclear family. First of all, he says that one reason for this is what he calls the decline, or really the collapse of chivalry. The old rules are off, and I have to confess myself sometimes, not so much with younger women, but with sort of middle-aged women, you know, do I open the door, do I get up, on the bus, what do I do? Some people will be offended if I do, some will be offended if I don't. I don't know the rules. Do I help on with a coat? You know, I just don't know any longer. So it's one example, but the collapse of chivalry is one example. Secondly, He argues another reason for the collapse is something that we've talked about before, the liberation of sexual activity from many of its, you know, former constraints, which is due to, you know, the enormous advances in contraception. And that's worked a tremendous change from older days. All right. Third, he argues as something as another cause for this, the pursuit of sexual pleasure as an end in itself and not simply for reproduction. And I'll come back to that point a little bit later in a little different sense, but it's one more cause. I'm just going through the causes, and then we'll go through them in some detail. All right, and the fourth, he argues, is the emotional overloading of personal relationships. In marriage, that is to say, that marriage is expected in our day and age to carry much greater load or carry much heavier freight than it was, you know, 50, 60, or whatever it is, 70, even maybe 20, 30 years ago. It's what we talked about last time with sport. That sport is expected to carry such enormous things today that it wasn't expected to carry, for a long time. He argues that many people are making, you know, really impossible demands on marriage, and since when they find out that marriage can't handle it, it collapses, and they don't really know why, and as a result, they find themselves in some very difficult kinds of situations. All right, with us now to pick up on these four specific things that I've mentioned here. He isn't arguing that let's go back to the old days. He isn't saying let's go back to an old traditional sort of Lady Guinevere, whoever it was. Was she the one about, you know, chivalry and the pedestal and the old code of the knights and all that sort of... somehow Lady Guinevere stays in my mind. Yeah, but isn't that the code of chivalry and all the rest? That's where it got started. He isn't arguing for going back to that, for women on a pedestal or anything else like that. He said chivalry is dead, and it should be, but he said it leaves all sorts of problems in its wake. All right. Mostly, he said that it is much more difficult, with chivalry is dead, it's much more difficult for men and women to confront each other or to relate to each other as friends and lovers than had been the case before. Because his reason for that is this: as male supremacy becomes theoretically untenable, and the emphasis is on theoretical there, as male supremacy becomes theoretically untenable, incapable of justifying itself, you see, as protection, that is, as chivalry, men, he argues, assert their domination more directly in fantasies and occasionally in acts of raw violence. This is a kind of a dynamite kind of conclusion. And as an example, he points to a study, and I've read the book, and there's much to it. There's a book on what's happened in, for instance, in movies, and the subtitle is From Reverence to Rape, is what's happened as men aren't able to cope with, you know, full equality. And if you read the Braunmueller book on rape, you remember that her argument is that this is the last resort in ways by which men can keep women, you know, subordinate to them, as they find other kinds of traditional roles, such as the role of chivalry, you know, disappearing altogether. All right, and he says that the women find themselves here in a very difficult, if not untenable, situation. He said they have abandoned the security of well-defined, protected social roles, and that once existed. And when they do that, they expose themselves to sexual exploitation. Okay. Let's just grant that for sake of argument. Then he argues that men lose sexual or long-range interest in the new feminists, the new crusaders, because these women are seen as, you know, direct threats to their own power. And therefore, there's a head-on clash here, what he argues is that we're right in the middle of this now, and really nobody knows where it's going to go or how it's going to come out. And what happens is certain aberrations break out from time to time that illustrate exactly what he's talking about. I don't know if you remember, just about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, in Madison, Wisconsin, a judge by the name of Archie Simonson. You all remember that classic one about when women dress in a more beguiling fashion, they're really asking to be raped, which, you know, got old Archie in a lot of trouble. They finally got rid of him, I think. Didn't they get him off the bench? I think, yeah. And of all places in Madison, I lived there 3 years, and you just, you know, maybe down in Tuscaloosa, Alabama or something, a judge could get by with something like that, but not in Madison, Wisconsin. Very,
different, you know, kind of town altogether. All right. But that's an example of Lash is trying to say here. All right. Now, to go on, he said, women today find it much more difficult to claim the traditional privileges of their sex. He said they are seen by men in oftentimes in fantasies, but that's sometimes even more important than reality. They are seen by men as, quote, libbers, that is, man-hating types of women, even though many of them aren't, and therefore they no longer find themselves being treated with the old kind of respect which they had known before. Now, he says that much of this is inevitable. Much of this change in the relationships between men and women is inevitable, but he said women pay a fearful price for it. To repeat here, what he's arguing is that males show a very irrational response to the new woman, and right now this kind of irrational response doesn't seem to be getting any better. So what he finds is that the battle between the sexes is in a state of flux, and nobody is really satisfied with how the battle is going. In fact, he makes a statement that the most difficult problem is not the fact that the women's movement has, you know, produced the kind of power and direction and momentum it has, but he finds a real problem in what he calls the irrational male response to the problem, as illustrated here. All right. Furthermore, he argues that another contributing factor to the intensification here of the social psychological battle between the sexes is that everybody has paid a very deep or very dear price in the demystification of sex. He argues this, that now with contraception and sex education so prevalent, everywhere the aura of mystery, of intrigue has disappeared. I remember, just as an example, one day, you know, you ask your children what they learned when they came home from school today, and my daughter in seventh grade, sex education, you know. One more time, she was so fed up with sex education, she'd seen all the drawings and the, you know, and all the rest of these things. And, you know, when I was in seventh grade, we were still trying to, you know, find somebody's, you know, medical book. And like in the movie, The Summer of 42, I don't know if you remember this marvelous movie where the boys got that medical book and, you know, went out on the beach and everything else. And now in seventh grade, sex education was about as important, you know, as classifying wasps or something. And that's, I say that deliberately because that's how Albert Kinsey got started. He was, you know, before he got into sexual studies, he was classifying gall wasps, which I don't know, you know, I don't know if that class, you know, qualified him for, you know, his next step. But anyway, the whole aura of mystery, of intrigue, has disappeared. He says that institutionalized sexual segregation has given away to arrangements that promote the intermingling of the sexes at every stages of life. You know, for instance, the dormitories. I still have trouble because I'm at my own alma mater when I, you know, co-ed dorms. I still, you know, when I ask somebody where you're staying, they say Thorsten. Well, you know, I remember when Thorsten was a male, a monastery kind of arrangement. I still can't imagine women, except every Saturday night there was this one guy. What was his name? Itchy Arsted, right? And he lived on sort of the ground floor. And what he did was take off the screen, and for a dollar you could bring your girlfriend through the window, and but he was there to charge his dollar. And old Itch, I goodness, yeah, he did a good, you know, did a, you know, anyway. With this, all right. What he argues here, and I quote: efficient contraception, legalized abortion, and I quote: realistic and healthy acceptance of the body have weakened the links that once tied sex to love, marriage, and procreation, which is a very, you know, that's, as I say, that's a blockbuster of a conclusion. All right. He argues this, that men and women pursue sexual pleasure, as we said before, as an end in itself, with no idea of its being romantic or permanent. And he gives some statistics if people are wondering whether or not, you know, this is just the fantasy of, you know, some researcher or something. The best statistics are that by the age of 21, some 95% of males and 81% of females have had intercourse at least once, which is, you know, quite a step or change since, you know, earlier days. All right, he goes on, sex valued for its own sake loses all reference to the future and brings no hope of permanent relationships. Sexual arrangements, including marriage, he says, you know, what we all know, can be terminated at pleasure. And this leads to, you know, the narcissistic response, indulgence without worrying about or commitment to the partner, seen usually as one more triumph simply for the individual, the thing we're talking about with manipulation with business, rather than a concern for, you know, the product itself. It's more for the process itself. Today, as he says, easygoing attachments encourage this kind of promiscuity as the norm. And his little slogan is here is that popularity replaces purity as a measure of a woman's social value with this. And furthermore, he says, today it is wrong, silly, uncivilized, gauche, whatever you want to call it, to be jealous. This is outrageous. It's to show some moral outrage or passion when one of the partners has overstepped the bonds of permanent relationship is thought to be, as I say, simply silly, outdated. We no longer talk about honor, commitment. All of this is passé. I just finished War and Peace, and there were two strong scenes in there about duels when somebody's honor had been violated, sort of thought that was kind of quaint, but it did illustrate some of the times. All right. Now, to go on with this, he said, as women have made their move, so to speak, they have dropped much of their sexual reserve. And now, here he goes on and puts the blame really on men here. To men, and this is an irrational approach, but he says, there it is, the women who have no longer maintain their sexual reserve, the men find that makes them much more accessible to sexual partners, but at the same time, it's much more threatening to men. Now, the question becomes why? Because he argues women are no longer docile or undemanding or obedient in the sexual act, but they enjoy it, they look forward to it. They're not the undemanding types as before. Oftentimes they can, quote, outperform men, and this becomes another weapon in the war between the sexes. Women don't have to, quote, get their way by being timid, coy, or dependent. Men used to like them this way, according to Lash, but now that full equality is apparent or almost apparent, males feel very threatened by this new kind of arrangement. So he argues this, again, damages long-term or permanent relationships, and what Lash is arguing is that the blame here really rests on the males far more than on the women with us. All right. So to restate the problem with the narcissistic overtones that he uses here. In our world, which is so conscious of psychology, with all the new information we have about sexual techniques of sexual performance and so on, with no fear of conception and all the rest, people are demanding, this is the point I said I was coming back to, people are demanding far more personal from personal relationships than ever before. Marriages are now, some things obviously which are done, are arranged, I should say, by the participants themselves rather than having marriages arranged by families, parents, and so on. And hence, people have a much greater sense that they are responsible for their marriages and expect maybe much more from them, and all the glowing titles that come with all the manuals that are so prevalent today. All right, but he says, given the trend towards narcissism, people are far more calculating and self-serving in what they will give or extend of themselves in any kind of long-range commitment. They want the end result, they want the kind of the happiness and the joy, but he says they are oftentimes not willing to pay the price for this. All right, now, he goes on with another explanation, another cause for this warfare between the sexes. All right, he argues that especially in the upper white middle class, that the sort of the traditional or the accepted wisdom here is that older, more traditional norms and fashion, norms and standards are simply no longer enlightened, they're no longer chic, that they simply represent a way of life, a code of morality that's long since passed. But in essence, he says, when you look beneath this, what you find, and this is a remarkable, I thought, insight in his part, is that many upper middle-class women have discovered, and that they now envy, the ability of blue-collar women to acknowledge that men get in their way, and that but that the blue-collar women acknowledge that men do get in their way, but they don't become man-haters because of it. He sees a very profound sociological difference here. In part, he says that is true because blue-collar couples don't spend so much time together. Each gives the other far more, space in terms of nights out. We talked about bowling, you remember last time, weekends and so on. And hence, the blue-collar people don't have the demands, the expectations, that the partnership is the only thing that gives them their, excitements and the reward. They have an entirely different sort of expectations about what marriage should be, and therefore he suggests that the marriages there are probably more stable in this particular area. All right, so to sum up that this far, we what he says is that the new feminist movement has made new demands on men, and when men fail to respond successfully, they find that the best explanation is to blame it on the women. Feminist consciousness raising, he says, has had irreversible effects. For instance, he says, once women have questioned the inevitability, once they have questioned the inevitability of their subordination and the practices which have surrounded subordination, they can no longer retreat to the safety and security, such as of these old practices. And therefore they are, you know, left in a much more difficult situation, which we haven't found any successful answers for at this time. And he says, he makes this interesting illustration here. He said, the new feminist who rejects the stereotype of women being weak and dependent can no longer find much comfort in the cliche, you know, that all men are beasts. She has no choice except to believe, on the contrary, that some men are human beings, and she finds it hard to forgive them when they act like animals. And he goes on here to make a very interesting quotation. He finds somewhere some older woman's advice to a younger woman, quote, "You want too much. You aren't willing to compromise. Men will never be as sensitive or as aware as women are. It's not just in their nature. So you have to get used to that and be satisfied with either sexual satisfaction or theoretical intelligence or being loved and not understood or else being left alone to do the things you want to do. Think about that."
That's
wow. All right. Anyway, he says that today's women reject that particular kind of alternative. And he argues that no woman should settle for less than a combination of sexual compatibility, compassion, and intelligent understanding. But when today's woman tries to find this, she will meet repeated disappointments, especially since men appear to find the demand for tenderness as threatening to their own emotional security. Thus, thwarted women develop, he says, a powerful rage against men. This rage emerges from a perception of marriage as the ultimate trap, the ultimate routine in a bureaucratic society, the ultimate expression of the dullness that pervades and suffocates modern life. So what Relash calls for, granted this sort of diagnosis here, is something of a showdown, if you like, or a shootout, whatever metaphor you want to use here, between the sexes. He argues that the situation can't continue any longer in its present condition. He says this, "Feminism aspires to change the relationship between men and women so that women will no longer be forced into the role of victim or shrew, as Simone de Beauvoir had said, you know, when she wrote her famous book some now 30 years ago. On the other hand, he says this demand makes women more shrewish than ever in their daily encounters with men. So conscious of being considered inferior, they read that into every, you know, female-male exchange, and even the most trivial." All right, and therefore, you know, we've come up against, as I say, this impasse. All right, and I quote him here. "This contradiction remains unavoidable so long as feminism insists that men oppress women and that this oppression is intolerable, and at the same time urging women to approach men not simply as oppressors, but as friends and lovers." So what has to happen, he argues, is that the air has to be cleared. That has to be thrashed out in any kind of successful relationship, because the situation right now is at an intolerable stalemate. And right now, he argues that most people really aren't willing to make the kind of risks and be vulnerable to be able to talk that one through through its its final implications. So where are we? He said. And he's obviously in a very precarious position. Deep, long-range personal relationships are increasingly risky. That is true because they no longer carry any assurance of permanence. Men and women make extravagant demands on one another and then experience irrational rage and hatred when these expectations are not met. People want to get away from attachment and move towards detachment and enjoy sex as they would enjoy, as I put down here, calisthenics or something else like that. By having casual sex, people can no longer make themselves vulnerable. So not wanting to take risks or be vulnerable, people get into various forms of narcissism. Other forms of escape, such as we've talked about, drugs, alcohol, for instance, or living alone with the idea of really getting behind solitude, reputing connections with either sex. The rising rate, he argues, of suicide among young people points to the same flight from emotional entanglements. Some of you might remember a psychiatrist at Harvard a few years ago, Hendon, what was his first name, wrote a book on this, on what's happening there as an example. But anyway. So he argues that the most frequent form of escape is promiscuity, masquerading as liberation, as being, progressive, as being cool, open marriage and all that goes along with that. So, what to do? How to improve the situation? Lash, as I've suggested, doesn't really spell this out, but he would suggest that what we have to get rid of is the idea that every person is entitled first primarily to their own instant immediate gratification at the expense of those with whom they become involved, that there is a necessity to return to a sense of responsibility, personal responsibility, for their own personal relationships, their marriage, their family, seen as a moral commitment, with the restrictions that come with that, but also with the greater rewards that go along with this sort of thing. All right. He argues, in just one last shot that he puts in here, he argues that the problem is aggravated by our kind of post-capitalist society with the advertising, because what's happening, especially in television, and in advertising too for that matter, is that we see, and this is true in novels, but especially in advertising, in television, we see all sorts of attractive alternative lifestyles on television, which seem to be, you know, much more exciting and bold and advanced than our own everyday dull life, and therefore we develop a much greater sense of dissatisfaction with ordinary everyday, you know, routine but necessary compromises and sacrifices for one another. And it is this kind of escapism in something like Three's Company, is an example of what he's getting at here, that people want to see because, in a way, it's like soap operas too, because it is an escape from their daily humdrum lives, and it also, you see, this is where the capitalism thing comes in, it also sells products. And therefore, so long as it sells products, we're going to keep getting these sort of things from the manufacturers and the advertising agencies all together. And therefore, yeah, as I say, as they sell products, and producers will give people what they think they want, and we're trapped in that kind of situation. All right.